Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. On New Year's Eve, 1999, President Bill Clinton announced a regime change in a nascent democracy. Boris Yeltsin was retiring from the presidency of Russia.
Under his leadership since 1991, the Russian people have faced the unprecedented challenge of building a new democracy and a new life after decades of corrosive communist rule. His lasting achievement has been dismantling the communist system and creating a vital democratic process within a constitutional framework. The fact that Prime Minister Putin assumes responsibility today as acting president in accordance with the Constitution is the latest example of President Yeltsin's achievement.
The new president, Vladimir Putin, had been an unknown a year earlier, and then suddenly, in a matter of months, became the most admired man in the country and its leader. The democracy Clinton referenced didn't come to be. Why not? Masha Gessen joins me now. Her new book is The Future is History: How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Welcome, Masha.
Hello. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. All right. If you have a question about the fall of Soviet Union and the rise of democracy and the fall of democracy in Russia, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. And I think people will have to listen a little bit before the questions come, because I want them to get a sense of what your theory is. So this book that you wrote isn't just a history of Putin's reign or the fall of democracy. You integrated the stories of some regular, there had been Soviets and then regular Russians, into the story. So it's this nonfiction narrative. And you set it in the mid-80s. At that point when your main characters were born in the mid-80s, what was the social contract between the Soviet Union and its citizens?
Well, that's a great question. It's odd to call something that we are used to calling totalitarianism, it's odd to call it a social contract, but that is what it is, right? It's it's an agreement that the citizens understand the state to have full control, that they no longer regarded communist ideology as being in any way important. It no longer played a role. It had played a role much earlier. But at that point, they didn't go too far out of line in any direction. And then suddenly, Gorbachev, the new, younger head of the Soviet Union, declares something called perestroika, something called glasnost. He starts discussing the history of the country. His people are talking even about the possibility of creating new political parties in addition to the Communist Party, or maybe splitting it into two parties. And so the system is destabilized, and very, very quickly it seems to fall apart. Or at least that's what we thought at the time. At the time, we, meaning both Western journalists and Moscow intellectuals, and I was both, we thought the system had crashed and we were going to see the triumph of democracy and freedom, because, like, what else would we see?
And the Russians themselves at this point were stunned, essentially, and they were fearful about, they didn't know what to do. They'd been under a totalitarian state, and suddenly they're told that there are these new freedoms. They didn't want to be too passive. They didn't want to be too active. And it feels like, and you wrote that the voices that were coming out then were the extreme voices.
That's exactly right. I mean, there were no sort of baselines in any way. One of the main characters in the book is a sociologist. I mean, the book is built around seven characters, four people born in the mid-1980s, and three people who sort of represent an intellectual history and deal with one of my main obsessions, which is that the loss of social science knowledge in Russia really made it impossible for the society to understand itself. So the sociologist who tries to study the society also discovers that there's no baseline. So what is he supposed to study? How is he supposed to ask questions in a society where questions have never been asked?
You say it's one of your main obsessions, and he has this theory about, he comes up with a theory called the how do you say it?
Homo Sovieticus.
Yes, yeah. So the Soviet man or the Soviet being. Who was that intellectual creation of his?
Right. So the explicit project of the Bolshevik Revolution was to create a new man, right? A new man who would exist in perfect harmony with a new society. And Yuri Levada was this Soviet sociologist, a great Soviet sociologist, a self-taught sociologist, and a sociologist who taught many other sociologists in a country where sociology was basically banned. So he had this hypothesis that Homo Sovieticus was not necessarily a person, but a set of behaviors that had developed in order to survive in the state of state terror. And his hypothesis was that Homo Sovieticus was characterized by doublethink, by this constant negotiation with the state, by being extremely sensitive to signals because it was a matter of survival, by being almost incapable of forming his or her own opinions. And so his hypothesis was that since there, a generation had passed since the Great Terror, since Stalin died in the mid-1950s, Homo Sovieticus was no longer necessary. So some Homo Sovieticus had to be dying out, and that would bring about the fall of the Soviet Union. And when he first was able to do a full study in 1989, he thought that this hypothesis was confirmed. And then when his center went back to do a study in 1994, they discovered something that they really didn't expect, which is that, yes, Homo Sovieticus existed as they had established in 1989, but it wasn't actually generationally bound. It was just as prevalent in the population 3 years after the fall of the Soviet Union as it had been 2 years before the fall of the Soviet Union. And they've done this survey every 5 years since, and they keep coming back with more or less the same results, a constant sort of proportion of Homo Sovieticus in the population.
So give a concrete example of how like someone would react as this Homo Sovieticus during a day differently than people in the West would react to, like at work or when speaking in public. So people can kind of get an idea.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I mean, it's hard to give actual examples of daily behavior, but mm-hmm. but let me just throw a couple of ideas at you. One is it actually comes from Hannah Arendt's writing about totalitarianism and specifically about the difference between totalitarianism and tyranny. And what she says is that under tyranny, the tyrant demands just a certain kind of behavior from his subjects, but they are left more or less alone in their private sphere, whereas totalitarianism leaves no room for the private sphere. Totalitarianism demands everything. And so totalitarianism robs the subject of the ability to form his or her own opinions. And so often we're puzzled, you know, how is it possible that Soviet citizens seem to be so supportive of democracy in the late 1980s and then so unsupportive of democracy mm-hmm. 10 years later? And how come hundreds of thousands of people were out in the streets all over Russia in 2011, 2012, and then most of them seem to have gone back to their regular work and regular lives, you know, none the wiser? And the answer is, unfortunately, probably, that for most of them, it was exercising their skill for feeling which way the wind is blowing. And it didn't speak to any core beliefs that they hold because they don't actually hold core beliefs, because it was dangerous to hold beliefs in Soviet society.
So if they don't want to have democracy and they are more comfortable under totalitarian regime, shouldn't they be able to choose that?
Well, the matter of choice becomes very complicated when you aren't actually given a choice, right? So we have this complicated negotiation where, on the one hand, yes, absolutely, Russians overwhelmingly supported Putin as he cracked down, as he destroyed what had been sort of achieved in terms of democracy in the 1990s. But his having done that means that Russians no longer have a choice. It's like the thing that they call an election in Russia, and this has been the case now for 18 years, the thing that they call an election is not an election. You know, none of the other candidates have access to media. None of the candidates can get on the ballot unless Putin personally allows them to get on the ballot. So I can't answer your question. You know, shouldn't Russians be able to choose totalitarianism? Because they aren't actually given a choice.
Why? How does it get passed on that the people who had lived under, remembered Stalin and lived in fear of being arrested randomly or turned in by their own spouses maybe even, that when that stopped happening, their children still feel that pressure or react in the same way as their parents.
So in the sort of intellectual history part of the book, which goes all the way through the book, I weave back and forth between the views of a sociologist whom I chose to sort of represent that field and the views of a psychoanalyst. And I think that's pretty productive because, you know, when we ask that question sort of in terms of political theory or in terms of sociology, we really are puzzled. How does a society continue to reproduce itself, continue to replicate certain behaviors, even if they're no longer necessary? Once we start thinking about it in terms of psychology, we're no longer puzzled because we understand that there's such a thing as intergenerational trauma. We understand that people inherit from their parents beliefs and attitudes and behavior patterns that actually aren't needed in their current circumstances, right? And so if it seemed perfectly reasonable to expect Russia to adopt democracy in 1991, if you looked at it from the point of view of some, you know, the end of history and some version of political theory, it certainly didn't look reasonable if you looked at it from the point of view of psychology. Because we don't expect people to emerge from a situation of extreme abuse and suddenly lead happy and healthy lives. And really, there's no reason why we should expect societies to do that, sort of shake off 70 years of totalitarianism and march forward toward freedom.
I think Americans have a hard time dealing with the idea of generational trauma, at least white middle-class Americans. We think, shake it off, bootstraps, every day is a new day, get going. Convince people out there who are right now skeptical about generational trauma that this exists. It feels like Americans have a hard time accepting this.
Really? I guess maybe that's living in New York, I don't feel that Americans have a hard time accepting that at all. I mean, there has been a lot of various kinds of science, both, you know, psychology and at this point, there are amazing genetic studies that show that, certain gene expression is passed on from generation to generation. I mean, there are incredible studies in Israel of grandchildren of Holocaust survivors who seem to have inherited certain traits because of the trauma that their grandparents lived through. But again, you know, let's think about the society for a minute as an individual. It's not always useful to think of societies that way, but I think in this particular case it's useful. If you have an individual who has been, say, subjected to, you know, human trafficking or extreme domestic abuse for many, many years, right? Mm-hmm. And these things, in psychology, they're comparable. They're trauma, right? And sort of the situation of control that you see in human trafficking gives very similar results to what you see in the situation of control under totalitarianism, right? So imagine a person who's been under extreme abuse for many years, and then that person is removed from the situation of abuse. And so you don't say to this, you know, child who was abused for many years, go ahead, you know, you have your freedom. Go build a happy, healthy life for yourself. You know this child needs treatment and care and intervention. And even then, it's likely that this person will go on to in some way reproduce the situation of abuse, right? Mm-hmm. Societies are kind of like that. We shouldn't expect societies to just be able to shake things off. Sometimes some countries are, I think, luckier in what they inherit, luckier in their ability to create a new story that will take them forward. But Russia's past is so awful, and creating a palatable story about it is possibly, you know, impossible.
When the Russians were gripped by nostalgia in the mid-90s, and, you know, like looking back on when Russia was great, what era did they look back to as the great time?
Well, in one way, there's no answer to that question because, and this should be very easy to understand for Americans because, you know, when a part of the American public says "Make America Great Again," it's not actually clear what era they're referring to, right? It's this generalized sense of an imaginary past that was better than the present, in which we felt more comfortable, more secure, somehow more ourselves, and weren't constantly confronted with things that make us uncomfortable and insecure. So that's the nature of Soviet nostalgia as well, right? What started setting in incredibly early, you know, by the mid-90s, there was like this cultural production of nostalgia that became very important. So just 4 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. But another part of the answer is, of course, World War II, right? The Russian victory, what Russians call the Soviet victory of what Russians call the Great Patriotic War, which, as Lev Gutkov, the sociologist, says, it's the perfect historical myth, in that it sheds its light, it shines its light backwards and forwards. Forwards, it explains how the Soviet Union became a superpower, and sort of maintains its claim to its superpower status, and backwards, it justifies all the terror that came before World War II.
Do you think Russia has had a harder time since the collapse of the Soviet Union than other parts of the Soviet Union, and that spun off into their own countries or their own regions? And if so, why?
I think it has, perhaps not harder than all of them, but harder than most of them. Most of the countries that were part of the Eastern Bloc, and most of the countries that were part of the Soviet Union proper. I think that a big part of the reason has to do with that inability to create a story, right? And again, there are two parts to this. One is that Russia never looked for post-imperial identity. There was never a conversation in the 90s about what Russia could be if it wasn't great. Russia remains an empire, but a smaller empire. So it's like the sense of greatness diminished. Many former empires have dealt with this problem of having to tell a new story about themselves now that they were no longer great and didn't dominate half the world as they saw it. But the other part of the problem is that is what to do with the period of totalitarianism. Because for post-Soviet countries that split off, the terror could be othered. A country like Estonia can say, truthfully, we were occupied by the Soviet Union and then by Nazi Germany and then again by the Soviet Union. And now that our 50-year nightmare is over, we can go back to being ourselves again. And at the core, we're good people, and our society is built on trust, and we're going to go back to that. And all the horrible things came from the other. Well, Russia can't say that. Russia can't say that someone else did it to us. We did it to ourselves. And what's even worse is that you can't tell a coherent story about the period of terror, because victims and perpetrators were often the same people. Sometimes, and there's a story in the book that I used to illustrate this, where a woman turned in her own husband and then lived with the consequences of that action and the extreme unhappiness that it caused her for the rest of her life. She became a victim by becoming a perpetrator. And that's sort of the classic Russian story. So you can't say these people were perpetrators, these people were victims, the perpetrators will apologize to the victims, and we will go on. It's not even clear how Russia can approach this horrible period and tell a story about it that can be not just acceptable, but that is in any way possible to assimilate and live with. And so the solution, which is not a solution, has been to ignore the period of terror, to try to not deal with it, and to call for reconciliation in the absence of truth.
I'm talking with Masha Gessen. She's the author of The Futurist History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. We've got a call from Chris in Minneapolis. Hi, Chris. What's your question for Masha?
Yeah, well, that's a really powerful story about the wife and the husband. I mean, that seems in check. I mean, it seems really powerful. So in America, we have we look to our history in World War II as a source of pride and a source of a great generation, and we did something really amazing. Russia was involved with that in an incredible way and on the right side of history. They suffered quite a bit of the majority of the loss. Does Russia look to their involvement in World War II as a source of pride like America, or is it flavored different? Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, do they call it the greatest generation the same way we do here?
Well, they don't call it the greatest generation the same way, but absolutely. It's the foundational myth of contemporary Russia. It's sort of, if you listen to Russians talk today, you would think that it was the only historical event that ever occurred, that there was no revolution, there was no war of 1812, there's only the Great Patriotic War. which is what Russians call World War II. And it's absolutely the formative myth. And, you know, it's very problematic because it's used, again, to justify the terror. It was very much a battle of two totalitarian states, and one won. And so that makes it very difficult to talk about Russia's totalitarian past because you're immediately accused of equating the two totalitarian regimes, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union won and so should have higher moral status.
Yeah.
But Russia, the Soviet Union fought the war as a totalitarian country. And that means, among other things, that the loss of 27 million lives, was a product of that, was a product of a society that didn't value human life in any way, that was willing to use people, millions of people, as literal cannon fodder. Many of them were unarmed. Many of them were faced with the if they had retreated, they would have been executed by their own. So they stood their ground basically as cannon fodder, as bodies that would be plowed down as the enemy moved forward. And so, again, it's impossible for Russians to talk about this very painful history because it is immediately cast as questioning the greatness of the victory. And that's a hard one to unpack because the victory was great. But does that justify everything that happened before?
This is NPR News. I'm Stephanie Curtis sitting in for Carrie Miller. Masha Gessen is with me. She is the author of The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. And we have a call from Chris in Eau Claire. Chris, you have experience living in Russia. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking the call, Masha. It's great to be able to speak with you. I remember reading your other article about the autocracy rules, and it really stuck with me all this time.
Thank you.
What I want to ask you simply this is that I've been to former Soviet Union about three times, 92 through 2000, and I noticed a very stark change over that period of time. There was certainly optimism and whatnot, but it had a lot to do more with the money and just it seemed to me that corruption went from being kind of behind the scenes to really flashing whatnot. And I want to ask you if you could just kind of tell me a little bit about how the corruption has changed a bit from the Soviet era, Yeltsin, and then even Putin. Because my understanding that was from some Russian friends is that part of the reason why they got so frustrated with Yeltsin had a lot to do with the fact that they were viewed as kind of weak and there was this terrible corruption and whatnot. But at the same time, I don't think that that's really gone away. So it's just, if you could kind of tell me a little bit about that, I'd greatly appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Right. That's a great question. And I'm glad that, Chris, you draw the line from the Soviet period to the Russian period and to the Yeltsin period and then to the Putin period, because I think that's exactly right. The Soviet system was incredibly corrupt, and that's not usually the way we think about it. But as you said, the corruption and not just the corruption, but also the extreme inequality of Soviet society was hidden behind the very strict sort of divisions and like literal walls, right? People in the nomenclature got their very, very good food from closed distribution centers that were behind unmarked doors. And then all of a sudden in the 90s, that was out in the open. Sort of the unequal distribution of wealth, the unequal distribution of privilege, the fact that some people had access to accumulating more wealth. People who were well-connected during the Soviet period immediately moved in to acquire state assets that were being privatized. And then Putin came in very much sort of riding this wave of unhappiness with the corruption and promising to make order out of chaos. And so he redistributed wealth once again to his circle, to his clan, right? And has created what the Hungarian political scientist Balint Magyar calls a mafia state. And I think that's exactly right. So because it's a mafia state, corruption has become its structural feature. And so a lot of the only protests that we see really anymore in Russia are protests against corruption because it is so clear and so oppressive and such a part of the daily life of Russians. But I don't think that there is any way to root it out without actually destroying the mafia state that Putin has built.
And it wasn't even the corruption that people found disheartening. It was just the fact that other people were better off. You wrote that they had, that people actually got out of Russia for the first time. You know, by 1995, about 70% of people had traveled outside of Russia. And you write, they felt themselves to not just be poor individuals, but people from a poor country. And their idea of how much they needed to live well continued to be out of reach. So it wasn't just that everything was stacked against them. It was that other people, it was that classic, are you happy? You're perfectly happy if everyone around you has the same amount of stuff. But the moment someone moves in who's got more, the levels of unhappiness in a country are off kilter.
That's exactly right. But there was also something else, another dimension to this, which had to do with a real shame for their country. Because there they were, you know, citizens of what had been a superpower. They had won, they had scored this great victory in World War II. And when they traveled abroad and they saw that even people who weren't particularly well off in poor European countries, such as Spain, for example, lived better than people who were pretty well off by Soviet standards, and then the countries themselves just appeared wealthier, that was a huge blow. It really bred a lot of resentment, and it was shocking. It was shocking to see just how impoverished most of the Soviet population was by world standards.
And I don't think people understand how far behind the Soviet Union was intellectually in a lot of areas, too. And that is a big part of your book. Is there are some like sociology and psychology and even economics where in other countries you learn from your mentor and your mentor learns from their mentor and you build and you have this breadth of knowledge. And once the Soviet Union fell, they needed a larger intellectual class out there. They didn't have the background. It was like they were all undergraduates and they were supposed to be the mentors and the leaders of the country.
That's a great way of putting it. It was a 70-year war on specifically the social sciences. The Bolsheviks realized very early on that that the social sciences, sort of as they had been constituted in Tsarist Russia, were a direct threat to their new regime. And so historians, philosophers, psychologists, sociologists were either exiled or executed. And for three generations, people couldn't get access to that kind of education. And people who took it upon themselves to try to educate themselves had to look for books in restricted parts of libraries. And, of course, their collections were extremely limited. And to me, one of the more poignant stories in the book is when the psychoanalyst Marina Arutyunyan, who has been practicing psychoanalysis for a long time at this point, she goes to a training school in the West, organized by Western psychoanalysts for psychoanalysts from countries where the psychoanalytic tradition has been interrupted. So for Eastern Europeans. And she observes a Western psychoanalyst at work, and she realizes that he's so much better than she is. And she calls it a narcissistic blow. And she realizes that he's not better because he's smarter or more talented or more caring or works harder. It's because he stands on the shoulders of his predecessors who stand on the shoulders of their predecessors who stand on the shoulders of giants. And she always is feeling like she stands on nothing. And I think that was such a painful realization. And in a way, it's similar to the realization of so many people who went abroad for the first time, that something that they thought they had or something that should have been theirs had been denied them. And they really can't make up for it.
But she had there's a phrase that you write about, the freedom from and the freedom to. She took that blow and she had, I hate to use the buzzword, but the resiliency to think, I now have the freedom to pursue the psychoanalysis and to further my career and further my studies for everybody, you know, for others and my students and for my patients. And other people felt when they saw that freedom out there, they got scared. It was like a vast open plain for them and they pulled back. Do you feel like that's more of the Russian character at this point from the totalitarian state, that freedom from, or was there a large number of people that are like her, where we now have the freedom to go forward, and there's and it's still there in Russia somewhere.
So this idea of two kinds of freedom, freedom from and freedom to, comes from the writing of Erich Fromm, who was the great German psychoanalyst and social psychologist, who wrote this wonderful little book that was published in 1940 called Escape from Freedom, which a lot of people, I think, read in college. But it's actually, now is a good time to go back and reread it. It's incredibly pertinent. But he talks about this idea that, you know, the freedom from is something that we all want. We all want our parents to stop telling us what to do. Freedom too is trickier because it's the freedom to invent oneself. It's the freedom to create one's own future. And it can be really frightening. And in fact, it can become an unbearable burden. And his hypothesis is that there are certain times in human history when things are changing so fast or have been changing so fast that a critical number of people find freedom too impossible to bear. And that's when they want to hand over their agency to someone who will take their freedom and do something with it and create a restricted space in which they're more comfortable, whether this person is Martin Luther or Adolf Hitler or Vladimir Putin or, you know, Donald Trump. I think there's a very strong argument to be made that we have seen in this country in the last few years is that same need to escape from freedom because the future is so uncertain and so frightening and the burden of creating it is so heavy.
I didn't want the whole hour to become Putin, Trump. But we've got 10 minutes left. And so John in Philadelphia, let's take your call. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for sort of setting this up. You know, I wonder how Trump plays into this dialogue and how the Trump, not just Trump himself, but certainly Trump's orbit, who seem to also have a sense that this is the right time to play on a certain segment of the American populace in a way that sort of caters to what you've just said about, you know, the safe space. And I'd love you to elaborate on that because I think it's very helpful for those of us that want to fight Trump, but also those of us that want to help the people that have the fear and to help raise their consciousness. Thank you.
Right. Thanks, John.
Thank you. So it's the oddest thing because, you know, I finished writing this book a couple of months before the election, and I sort of raised my head from my desk and realized that I had just been doing this relevant research, which is certainly the last thing I expected. Right. But I think that in as much as the book is very specifically a book about the legacy of Soviet totalitarianism, there are certain things that actually cross over. And I think that the thinking and writing and reading that I did about this, the fear of the future, the sense that one is unable to plan one's future or that it's just too hard and the ground underneath one's feet is just too unstable, that has been very important to me to be able to understand what's happening in this country. And I think that the way and to understand the appeal of the imaginary past. And the imaginary past is what both Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump traffic in extremely successfully. And it's imaginary because it's a past that never happened, right? We don't know exactly what it was. But we just know that when they use buzzwords like make America great again or Russia great again or traditional values or going back to the basics, you know, all of that somehow communicates that you can be in a place that was safer. And I think that the way that you counter it is you don't talk about how wrong that is, and you don't talk about it how bad the past was or how wonderful our present is, which is, I think, what Hillary Clinton did unsuccessfully. I think you talk about the future. I think you create a vision of the future that makes it imaginable and that makes it imaginable in an appealing way that makes people want to move forward and enter a new and, yes, unknown era, but one that is perhaps more appealing than the state of instability that they're in right now.
David in St. Paul has a question for you. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
What's your question?
Well, I'm wondering whether if, in your view, in the modern totalitarian Russian Federation, the violent acquisition of Crimea is a matter of national pride for the citizenry to boast about, or if it's just a tract of land that Putin had acquired and conquered, leaving the people to just attribute it to leadership as opposed to the country's victory in battle.
Right.
Thank you, David.
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you, David.
I
should make it clear, actually, that I'm not claiming that Russia has a totalitarian regime. I think Russia's regime is best characterized as a mafia state. But Russia has reverted to acting like a totalitarian society, right? And one of the distinguishing characteristics of a totalitarian society is its mobilization, right? That's what makes it different from authoritarianism. It is always in battle. It is always mobilized against real or imagined enemies, whether they're external enemies or internal enemies. And it's brought together by victories. I mean, all societies are brought together by military victories, but they become much more important in a totalitarian society. And it needs to have the sense of constantly moving forward and acquiring more victories, which is why we've seen Putin declare victory in Syria at least twice so far. But I think Crimea was really a turning point. Crimea was when Putin managed to mobilize Russian society in a profound way for the first time. It was really when I think what Lev Gutkov, the sociologist, calls recurrent totalitarianism really took shape. And we saw that in Putin's so-called popularity numbers, and I say so-called because, of course, again, there's no alternative, but he shot up from about 50% to about 86%, and he's stayed at that level since. And what's really frightening is that at the very same time, the Russian economy really started tanking, and so people's sense of economic well-being and their economic confidence plummeted. And this is something that you never see in a democratic society. You never see people supporting a leader overwhelmingly while also feeling very insecure economically. But you do see it in a totalitarian society. In fact, totalitarian societies thrive on poverty. So to answer David's question, Crimea is very much this mobilizing factor and really has become very important to Russia's current identity.
At the end of you wrote a biography of Putin a couple of years ago, and at the end you were very hopeful about the people reaching, protesting around the country and the fact that maybe things would change. How hopeful are you right now for Russia and for people's freedoms there?
Well, that was an important lesson for me because I had written that biography of Putin that was not exactly an optimistic book. But as I was about to go to press, the protests broke out. And so I wrote an epilogue in the course of 1 week of the protests. And I learned that one should never put in a book something that one had just written. but I also realized that, you know, I had covered many successful revolutions, not many, but several. And I never questioned, you know, this revolution, what felt like a revolution in 2011 in Russia felt exactly the same as revolutions I had covered. And so I never asked myself, you know, do unsuccessful revolutions feel differently from the inside than successful revolutions? As it turns out, they feel exactly the same. It's just they fail, right? So this book is largely about what has happened since the failure of that revolution, the crackdown with which Putin responded to the protests of 2011, 2012, and the way that crackdown has restored sort of totalitarian institutions to Russian society. At this point, it's really hard to see a way forward for Russia. I think Putin has succeeded in creating a closed system that will end either when he dies or when he makes some sort of catastrophic mistake, but it will not end as a result of pressure from the outside, including from Russia's own citizens.
Americans in the Pew Research Centers has been asking Americans about their faith in institutions for decades now, and it's at a real low point, Americans' faith in major institutions. What lessons do you hear in that?
I think we're really at a moment of reevaluating institutions and really maybe even changing our understanding of what institutions are. I mean, we can distinguish between formal and informal institutions, but I think a lot of Americans believed that there were many things that were institutions that were actually cultural institutions, informal institutions, habits, norms, customs, right, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. And they can fall pretty fast, but even formal institutions can fall. And I think that is a realization that we're just coming to. Formal institutions of democracy depend on everybody acting in good faith. And when you have someone like Donald Trump who doesn't act in good faith, I think the travel bans are actually a very good example. What we saw was a sterling example at the beginning of the institution of the judiciary sort of doing its job while being pressured by the institutions of civil society, right? It was beautiful. It was exactly the way things should work in the American democracy. But then on the other side, you have a bad faith actor who is Donald Trump, who continues to issue one travel ban after another as though the courts didn't exist and as though the courts were an adversary and not another branch of government that informs how the government moves forward. And he seems to be wearing the courts down. I mean, gradually the travel ban, which remains substantially unchanged, has gone into effect. And at this point, I don't have a whole lot of faith in the judiciary being able to stop him, precisely because he's acting in a way that the institution isn't actually designed to be able to fend off.